Good morning, Radio Land. Good morning, world. Good morning, everybody. This is Fresh FM. I'm Grant, and this is Fresh Start Friday on the 1st of December. And a brilliant day it is, too. Sunny and warm. And I've got two guests in the studio with me today, two people to help co-host the show. On my right, as you can see, I've got Sammy all the way from Australia and Britain, and on my left I have Jeff all the way from the world. Good morning, fellas.
Good morning.
The world is a very distant place.
It is a distant place. Well, fine, fine, fine. Everything is fine.
You just used the word fine 36 times in the weather.
Oh, well, that's got to be a good thing.
Fine, mate.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's all fine around here.
Well, sometimes rain could be fine.
Oh, of course,
if you've had drought.
Yep, it is totally. So, what are we going to talk about today, fellas?
The royal wedding.
Ah, the royal wedding. Yes,
that's a sport. And then sport.
Yeah. So tell me about the royal. What are your thoughts? You're a Brit, Sammy. Thoughts about the royal wedding? Are you excited? Have you got your ticket?
I'm a little bit angry. I haven't received my invite.
Me either. I'm severely disturbed.
Where's my gold envelope?
My too. I what's up with that? I don't even. Wait, who are these people again?
There's a Harry. There is. Oh yeah. Somebody, I suppose, he has to be marrying somebody.
She's from across the Atlantic somewhere, the other continent.
In the world of today, correct me if I'm wrong, would it not be impossible that the royal wedding could be between two members of the same sex?
I was wondering this. I mean, what do you think? There might be some kind of outrage even so?
That would be wonderful.
Well, what are the laws in England, according to, about that? Can they do that now?
They can.
Yeah.
That's been legalized.
Yep.
How about interspecies marriage?
Now we're getting a bit donkey.
We know that's legal in New Zealand, of course.
Is it?
Interspecies.
Well, it's legal for sheep to wear lipstick here, isn't it?
Sheep can do whatever they want.
Right.
Yeah.
But Australia has millions of more sheep than New Zealand.
But no gay marriage.
Yet.
Yes.
But these are issues of profound significance, and now to sport.
Okay, tell me about sport.
Well, there's a new sport that I came up with, if you could call it a sport. It's called aerobic chess. Aerobic chess is where you've got a chessboard on a pedestal, and you've got two treadmills on either side of the pedestal, but facing opposite directions. So in other words, you can have a pedestal with a chessboard, and you've got two people that are running on the treadmill, but they're standing in position, and they're on either side of the chessboard. So the goal is you have to keep running until somebody wins the chess game. Aerobic chess.
Sounds like it could be, good. Yeah, that's pretty good score.
That I would watch.
I would watch it once.
It's got layers. It's got a lot of,
it does.
There's a fair bit going on.
Well, this is the first time.
A game of mind and body.
Exactly. This is the first time I've shared this with the world. And I may as well share one of my most important inventions. It's called digestible Velcro. Digestible, you know what Velcro is? It's the little strips of stuff that stick. Digestible Velcro would be used when McDonald's goes into orbit. You've got your hot chips, or your, in America we call them French fries. You've got them floating in a zero gravity environment. So each French fry would have a tiny strip of digestible Velcro on it to hold it in place so it doesn't float away until you eat it. Then you digest it and it's gone. So there you go. Elon Musk might steal this patent from me.
It's a good idea. Okay, so if everybody's listening,
this is important stuff. Yeah. We swore that we were going to talk about only very
the biggest issues of
important stuff, and so we're covering that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a really, really smart move, guys. Hey, Sammy, you've only just arrived in the country not so long ago. You're traveling from Australia. Whereabouts in Australia you come from?
Well, I'm just about an hour's drive northwest of Brisbane, up in Queensland, from a part of the world called the Samford Valley. And I'm over here for a few weeks, travelling north. I have a departure date set in a couple of weeks, so I'm just connecting the dots.
And speaking of connecting, you're connected. I've dragged you in here kicking and screaming at a cruelly early morning time because you also are part of a community radio in your valley?
Native Brisbane, yeah. So out of the valley over in Brisbane, we have a community radio station, 4ZZZ, and I've been a part of the station doing bits and pieces for the last year or so. Started out actually through school. I took a work experience a week and just kind of stuck around. I loved it, and they have a very similar mission statement too. So I was reading up on the wall here to provide an independent voice that empowers minorities and celebrates diversity. Ours is very similar. It's connecting and amplifying the voices in our local communities. So I'm no stranger.
Great.
To this, and I love being in here. So even if I was kicking and screaming, I am happy to be here now.
I bribed you with a pancake. Yeah. I thought that might do the job.
Oh, absolutely.
Is the Sanford Valley close to Montville and Moline?
Not too far, actually. That's a few hours north.
Okay, because that's the inland hinterland of the Glasshouse Mountains. So you're south of there.
Yes.
But that's beautiful country.
That's a brilliant part of the world, yeah. I took it's a great road trip country.
Yes.
Go out there, and the Glasshouse Mountains are particularly spectacular. They're the plugs of old volcanoes.
Absolutely. And I think we talked about last week on this last visit to Australia, I got to visit this area called the Warrumbungles down in extreme northwest New South Wales. But it, too, is over 100 ancient volcanic chimneys, very similar to the Glasshouse Mountains, but there's many more of them. But this area, it's a high desert area on the west side of the Great Dividing Range, but it's where the largest astronomical observatories in Australia are.
Hey, tell me about the, speaking of volcanoes, we're hearing this week that there's a volcano, I've forgotten its name, you might have...
Agung. In Bali.
Agung in Bali, is erupting... or at least threatening to erupt by spitting out a bit of ash and stuff.
Well, they've cancelled all the plane flights out of there now.
Yeah, well, the wind changed and a lot of planes got out of there.
Did they?
Just because the wind changed direction. But it's looking a little bit grim for the people that live there, perhaps. I mean, what do you expect if you live on the edge of a volcano?
Yeah, volcano.
You know, we live on fault lines. You know, expect the expected.
I love volcanoes. When I was on the Big Island of Hawaii about 4 years ago, I went up to the largest volcanic caldera on the planet. It's called Kilauea. It's absolutely huge, and down in there are many different layers and different craters, and there's lava erupting all the time. They call it's the most active volcano on the planet. But unfortunately, lava had been flowing down and into the ocean for like 30 years up until about the month before I went there, and then a lava tube collapsed and it stopped, so I didn't get to see that. And then a few months after I left, it started again.
Must have seen you coming, Jeff.
Exactly. So what it means is I've got to go back and to photograph this, but it's some of the most spectacular views of natural phenomena that you'll ever see. The beauty of this molten lava and how slowly it moves and cools and going into the ocean and then underwater. It's really, really, really
does
amazing.
It make the ocean warm there, or is the ocean just so big it's not even going to affect it?
Well, I think it's warm right around where it's going in, but instantly the water, the glowing molten lava, when it hits the water, it instantly turns dark and cools, and it makes this cloud of steam.
Yeah.
But they call Pele is the Hawaiian goddess of the volcanoes. So the volcanic eruptions, the lava, it's Pele giving birth to new land. And they say that the land area of the Big Island actually increases by several hundred kilometers per year. Because
not
of
much.
It's a lot.
Yeah,
it's more than
square. Square.
Yeah, the new land is being created as the lava actually extends out into the ocean and stuff. But I love volcanoes. I climbed what they say is the third most active volcano in the world. The Spanish name is Villarrica. It's near Pucón, Chile, where the Mapuche name is Rucupión. But it's got like little streams of lava flowing down. And I love volcanoes.
You were able to jump over them and move past them?
No, but under the Pinochet regime, one of their ways of disposing of people was to throw them down in the crater. But the only active volcano,
like Gollum, eh?
The active volcano in New Zealand is on White Island. It's an island.
That's right. Yeah, we get Ruapehu coming to life occasionally.
Yeah, it's not extinct.
No, well, actually, neither is
Narahoe.
Yeah, well, Taranaki. Taranaki's not extinct. It's just sleeping. Yes. So, and after the earthquakes in Christchurch down in Banks Peninsula, which is also another old volcano, some new pockets of hot water started bubbling up from the earth. So,
yes. Well, I have an important question.
Yep.
Whose fault is this?
Ours. We own it all.
Who can we blame?
It's the Transalpine's fault. Mm,
it says. Yep. Well, we are a genius.
Grant, thanks for having us on your show, man.
Oh, hey, pleasure.
We have to cover the other two most important categories of public information: food and fashion.
For food and for fashion.
Absolutely. And in the line of food, I'd like to thank you, Grant, for your beautiful pizza that you made. And that you made one without blue cheese, just for little me. But it was very awesome.
It was for three of you, because yes. Three of you didn't like it. But yeah.
Then with a polenta base, this is true commentary on beautiful food. And along the lines of fashion, what are the new sex robots going to wear?
Yeah, now that's an interesting one. Did you read about it, those sex robots? I mean, it's becoming quite a reality.
That's the third F.
Yeah.
In fashion.
Yeah.
And effing.
Yes. So, yeah, what is the score with that? I mean, you know, they'll be giving rights to robots soon.
May I share this with you?
Married to them.
May I share this? This is just an extension of something that a friend of mine in the Deep South back in the States shared with me. He said, like, the best sex that he ever had was when he took a watermelon and he let it heat up in the sun.
Oh, that's enough.
And then he cut a hole in it.
People having their breakfast.
So, yeah, yeah.
And so, this is just the next step: a robot for people
heated up in the sun.
a robot with no clothes.
Yeah,
to have sex
that's
with.
So weird, isn't it? It's just a strange world we live in. Yeah,
and getting stranger.
And getting stranger.
So when you say fashion, will they come with clothes in the shop?
Well, that was what the issue I was trying to bring up. But what would the sex robots wear?
Yeah,
can't have them indecently exposing.
They're probably not wearing anything. It's probably working all fine. Anyway,
they'll be allowed to go naked, unlike us.
Right. Okay, so
we've covered all the really important stuff now.
Yeah.
Cross them off the list.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me about the. We were talking last week about some interesting stuff, and we were talking yesterday about some interesting. We talk all the time. When you're around, Jeff, we always have interesting conversations.
Well, Grant, I can't thank you enough for having me. It's very inspiring being at your place with all the nice people, and I'm getting a lot of work done, and it's really, really cool. But may I just share that if we continue a little bit down the path of speaking about geophysical warfare, which is kind of like the new paradigm of quote-unquote war fighting, I'd like to just acknowledge that my friend Dr. Claudia von Werloff in Austria, she's a leading, I won't use the word authority, but she's an academic person that's very involved in the European Union with educating people about geophysical warfare, and she's carrying on the work of Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who was an American Catholic nun, a medical doctor, and a global expert on the health effects of ionizing radiation. And then in the year 2000, she came out with this a legendary book called Planet Earth, Latest Weapon of War, where she's examining the whole paradigm of geophysical warfare and what that means. But she passed away in June of 2012 after having my last communication with her. She asked my permission to reprint part of an article that I wrote that involved about the whales and dolphins and the effects of military industrial technologies on them. She really loved them. And so Claudia von Werloff is very much carrying on this work. But Claudia von Werloff has a brand new article that went up on what I consider to be one of the top truly credible sources of information on the internet. It's called globalresearch.ca. Founded by Dr. Michael Chashidovsky, who's a professor of economics in Ottawa, Canada. But this article that went up yesterday, it's Claudia von Werloff's
comprehensive summarization of the entire paradigm of geophysical warfare. And she lists my article that I wrote in 2011, giving birth to a new concept called geoterrorism. She lists my article in there as one of the main references. So I'm very much honored to be included in this, but I strongly recommend that you check this out, globalresearch.ca. And the article is by Dr. Claudia von Werloff.
There's some really interesting stuff out there. How do we tell the difference between the bogus kind of misinformation stuff on the internet and the real stuff?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's very parallel to one of the strategies of geophysical warfare, like we talked about last week, that the people that have envisioned this whole paradigm say from day one that the vast majority of people in the world are not going to be able to tell the difference between weather events that have been engineered and ones that are happening naturally. Because if you think about it, Mother Nature makes storms and hurricanes, and Earth has earthquakes, and we have droughts and stuff like that. So really, if someone's manipulating your behavior through different ways, they might make you do something that's still a possible form of human behavior, but it's like, what's the driving factor behind it? The same with weather engineering, the same with trying to determine the difference between something that's bogus and something that has truth. And it's actually very complex, because one of the modus operandi of manipulating what people think is to use a certain amount of what is commonly accepted as truth. And then they tie in the bogus little bit in this larger context. And so you have to sort of educate yourself about the psychology of mass media.
So like a royal wedding, for instance.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm not going to disagree that is probably the most important topic in the news of today. Mm. Even though I couldn't tell you who's involved in it, but it is important nonetheless.
Precisely, but that's exactly what you're getting at, isn't it?
Well, but this is part of the Orwellian oxymoronic environment that our minds are in these days, that there is literally there's very little coherence in the worldview being promulgated by mass media. It's an unending sequence of sound bites. Like if you listen to the news that was on earlier, every day, it's the exact same template with just very slight variations thrown in there.
And it's been that way for a long time.
Absolutely.
So do you reckon there's a shift on the way, or is it happening? Is people slowly realizing?
Very good question. A lot of people go, well, yes, a lot of people are waking up. But I go like, but yeah, as soon as they wake up, they go, oh my God, and then they go right back to sleep again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's probably true.
Yep, nothing wrong with sleep. You just don't want to be sleeping while you're driving.
Sleep at the wheel, great band.
Yes. I remember that. I think I actually saw them live once.
Yeah, they're a bit of a Western swing band. Yeah. Look, it's interesting, the whole what you talk about. And we talked about the concept of that trilogy. And that kind of brings to mind, you know, that trilogy you were talking about. Now, tell us about that. I know it's science fiction.
Well,
science fiction, well, you know, I grew up, and you and I, Jeff, we grew up in the 60s watching Star Trek and Lost in Space, going, wow, what cool concepts. You know, doors automatically open now. Wow, they never did. You know what I mean? It's like all that stuff has become reality, and we've gone beyond that reality. So look at the science fiction. And so the science fiction book that you were sort of mentioning last night was a little bit like that. And it really touched a chord. Tell us the book.
Well, it's called The Colossus Trilogy by D.F. Jones from like the mid-1970s. But the basic story is that the U.S. government created a supercomputer in order to manage all its nuclear weapons. And the computer was called Colossus. And so when they brought it online, the very first thing that it did was it said, warning, warning, there is another. And it through its global network of sensors and inputs, it detected that the Soviet Union already had a similar computer that was online.
Hang on a minute. You say this book was written in the 70s.
Yes.
So that's before the internet.
Well, I think that the precursors of the internet might have existed.
Yeah, but it's taken that.
Well, absolutely.
It's already becoming. So carry on. That's just a point I wanted to make.
So these two supercomputers instantly were in touch with each other, and so for the next like 48 hours, they shared all their voluminous amounts of information with each other. And then, when it was finished, this new sort of super entity had just been born. And then it started giving the people directions on what to do, because these computers had both been programmed to not only be in control of all the nuclear weapons and the arsenals and stuff in order to manage all the information and to make the critical decisions that a human being wouldn't have time to do, but their programming was to eliminate war. And they proceeded to do that, but they did it by restraining man, because man is his own worst enemy. This is a quote from Colossus, and it commanded Dr. Forbin, who had been its creator, to create a voice module. "This is the voice of world control. I bring you peace. It may be the peace of plenty and abundance, or the peace of unburied death. The choice is yours. Obey me and live. Disobey and die." That's what the computers... It's like the ultimate electronic dictator.
Uh-huh.
But they made a movie called The Forbin Project about this, which details about half of one book. But what really happens, and this actually ties in with the vision of Dr. John Lilly, the scientist whose dolphin group I worked with in California, he perceived that in the world of today, if you look around, you see a battle going on between what we call... Well, it's life as we know it is based on water, and this very, in the world today, a substance has become very controversial, carbon. Carbon is what life is made of. Well, in the same periodic family as carbon, the next level down is an element called silicon. And silicon is very abundant in the Earth's crust, but it's also what solid-state electronics are made from. So John Lilly perceived that there is a battle going on in the world of today between water-based life, which is life as we know it based on carbon, water, DNA, a few main elements, but what he called the solid-state entity, or an electronic intelligence based on silicon, electricity, and computers, and that the solid-state entity actually exists on other planets, but that on the Earth, it has been using us, controlling us below our level of awareness, not only to create more of it, but to eventually take it all to the level so that it can have control of itself. And we're actually crossing these thresholds now. In the real world, we've got robotic mining. There's several mining sites operated by Rio Tinto in Western Australia that only have a handful of human employees, and they're mechanics. All the mining, the transport of the ores, and everything is automated. And we could get to the level soon where this whole chain of the manufacturing and everything is out of human control. But what happens in these science fiction books is this goes to the next level. The computer network eventually takes over. It eradicates the oceans and the atmosphere from Earth because it doesn't like water. And it saves a few token humans in a dome to honor its creator, but it spreads its electronic circuitry over the surface of the whole Earth. And then by volume 3 of the book, it moves the Earth out of its orbit in the sun to go in search of other beings like itself. And that's pretty far-fetched, but Elon Musk may have something like this in mind. But John Lilly also saw that the whales and dolphins are the most powerful transceivers of the energy of water-based life on Mother Earth. They're sort of like the guardians of life on this planet. They live in the ocean. And through their amazing abilities that are probably so far beyond us in terms of what we might call psychic or psychological powers that we can't even imagine, possibly involving their perception and use of sound, their ability to tune into the giant crystal that the ocean of the planet really is. The ocean is really a giant water crystal. And what people, something I've learned that's very interesting is that water is one of the most unique substances that we know of. And when you've got a body of water, because of the molecular bonds, any contiguous body of water functions as if it was one giant molecule of water. So water is able to be connected with itself in ways that no other substance is. So the whales and dolphins are in tune with, this is Lily's vision,
yeah.
And I think it might be possible, they're in tune with water-based life on other planets and other star systems, and they're primarily responsible for maintaining that connection here. But that's why the solid-state computer entity doesn't like the whales and dolphins. It's been trying to convince humans to wage war on them, as well as all of life, because its eventual agenda involves getting rid of biological life. But the scary part is when you look around in the world, so much of what military-industrial civilization is doing is exactly this.
Now we can go to talking about manipulating behavior and thinking. And, Grant, you asked a question a few episodes back about, you know, how do you know what to believe with all the infotainment and information out there? And
I just asked it. I just asked it again to Jeff a few minutes ago.
I heard that. Mm. And I do find that an interesting topic too, but my rule has become whenever I hear any of these, like, false flags or things, is who benefits from this so-called event? And I must say, I do think some of these events are, you know, perpetrated in a manner that is simply to manipulate our behavior and thinking. So I think that's the way to figure out who is, what the truth is, what we're hearing, who benefits. You know, when you hear a so-called terrorist attack and then the next thing you hear is the President of the United States saying, well, obviously we have to increase our surveillance for your own protection and those kinds of things. What do you reckon, Jeff?
Absolutely. I like the Orwellian terminology, non-lethal weapons.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I think we have non-lethal genocide in the world of today. But, Victoria, you might find this interesting. Actually, in 1984, I was sitting at a cafe in Berkeley, and I was actually only a few blocks from where this guy named Edward Teller lived. But I only found that out later. You know who he was, the guy that fathered the hydrogen bomb, and he was the inspiration for Dr. Strangelove. Mm. And he was also one of the first people to advocate the use of aerosol chemicals being dispersed in the atmosphere. But I was making some notes, and this word popped into my head, infotoxin.
I like it.
Well, it was short for information toxicology, and so I recorded it as a techno rap song that was kind of like a piss take on, you know, mass media and mediocrity and public artifacts and stuff. But then I developed it as a serious concept, information toxicology. And I learned that the word toxin comes from the ancient Greek word toxon, T-O-X-O-N, that means like a poisoned arrow. So a toxin was originally a poison on an arrow, so it was a weapon. So infotoxin is about the weaponization of mass communication. And this magazine called Adbusters, that used to be really cool, they're a Canadian magazine, they published my debut article in 1990. But I think that kind of relates to the whole infotoxin hypothesis is basically what we're talking about. It's the systematic manipulation of what people think of as reality, and the Nazis had a concept called my German accent's not very good, but it's Weltanschauungskrieg, in German, it means worldview warfare. And that's when the Americans imported this after World War II, it became psychological warfare. So, and there was also this guy named Edward Bernays back around the 1920s, who was a very influential on giving birth to the whole science of public relations. And so all this is one of the most scientifically evolved disciplines that the powers that be use to influence what people think of as reality.
It is global psychology.
Absolutely.
And the people who are manipulating the way that the masses behave have immense power. I just find it fascinating watching even things like, for example, when we need to demonize these countries in order to have wars. Because, you know, we have to have a us and them attitude. So North Korea, it was just a regular lamestream news bulletin, and they just swiftly went past. Oh, and North Korea, who is thought to have been behind the, cyber last year?
The big cyber attack.
Yeah. And they got away with saying that just thought to have been behind it.
Yes. Well, if you look back in time, North Korea has been an evil bogey demon ever since like the 1970s.
Yeah.
They've been doing the same thing over and over and over again. And it's like there's an organization called FAIR, F-A-I-R, it stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And they do some quite interesting investigative journalism. And they told a few months ago that there's a major think tank called the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And they advise the Pentagon and the government on defense investments. And they are largely funded by Lockheed, who's the biggest defense weapons manufacturer on the planet. Well, they just recommended that in the wake of the supposed North Korean missile tests and all this, that the U.S. government invest hundreds of billions of dollars in this Lockheed missile system called THAADS, T-H-A-A-D-S. They wanted, CSIS is recommending to the U.S. government that they pay Lockheed hundreds of billions of dollars for these missile defense systems to be installed in South Korea, in Hawaii, which is now being one of the major, Kauai is one of the major military and largest microwave transmitter places on the planet.
I used to live on Maui and watch bomb Kahalabi every day.
Wow.
For target practice, you know. So just the word that you used there a few minutes ago, describing this Lockheed entity as a defense system, you know, that says a lot in itself, that the whole world is thinking that this entity, we have to defend the good guys, which are of course the ones wearing the white hat.
Yes, well, but back before World War II, it was called the Department of War. But after World War II, Orwell set in. It became
names and make them like right here in our own region. We used to have a dam proposal called the Lee Valley Dam proposal. It's now been renamed as some kind of community of bullshit.
Community.
Anyway, terminology and the whole psychology. And I mean, yesterday in the lamestream news, they even said that North Korean's leader was 5'7". I mean,
and so
intolerable. They said on the news that when they were demonizing how awful North Koreans are, and their leader is so bad, and he's 5'7".
He's short. How dare he's him?
5'7". This should not be allowed.
Well, we were talking about this very thing last night, actually.
Yes,
it's really funny.
Mr. Phillips, 44, and I go, "Is that years or centimeters?"
As if that was identifying.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, oh, you're the 44-year-old.
No, but
what's your name again?
My inseam is 34 inches for my pants.
Yeah.
And also yesterday in our news, I don't know if you heard, but after years of intensive investigation on the 2/3 of the people who were killed in the Christchurch earthquake were in one building, the CTV building, after spending $1.2 million an intensive police investigation. I found nobody responsible.
Come no, back, absolutely.
Well, go back to sleep, everybody, and dream about McDonald's. Maybe one will move in on your block, and then, you know, it'd be great.
Well, Victoria, can I share this with you really quick? I didn't have a chance to go into it last week, but this relates. The Christchurch earthquake, did you know that on the very day of the quake and the day before, there was this conference going on called the U.S.-New Zealand Global Partnership Forum? And in Christchurch, on the day of the quake, were several of the highest level U.S. government disaster management people that exist, including Timothy Manning, who was the deputy director of FEMA, Admiral Thad Allen of the U.S. Coast Guard, who's he's the disaster magnate. He headed up the U.S. official response to Hurricane Katrina and the official U.S. response to the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster in 2010. These people were there, and a host of other people were in Christchurch when this quake happened. And there was a contingent of 8 U.S. congressmen, including Kurt Campbell. They were part of the Pacific Affairs Committee or something like that. They were in Christchurch. An hour before the quake, they flew to Wellington and were in John Key's office when the quake happened. There's all these really, really, really weird anomalies. Another one is that if you look at how they measure the damage that earthquakes do, they have a thing called the region of maximum displacement. It's the area in which the earth moves the most during an earthquake. Well, the Christchurch quake was really unique because the area of maximum displacement was extremely well defined as one sort of area with very discrete boundaries. But that region of maximum displacement happened to correspond exactly to the CBD of Christchurch. And if you think about it, what would be the probability of that happening naturally?
Well, you know, again, I always ask the question, who benefits? And I think somewhere in some office, perhaps the one that you mentioned, some people were saying, hey, it worked.
Yes. Well, did you know that one of the benefits is that in the wake of 9/11, in the wake of the Christchurch quake, which I think has functioned as New Zealand's 9/11, a false flag of a different type, that Lockheed has basically been given control of New Zealand's military.
Oh, well, you know, I have read that, you know, we need to have closer relationships so that our equipment can, you know, work alongside the same equipment that the American defense people use. So it's all for your own safety, darling.
Absolutely.
You?
And another thing that seems key in this is that New Zealand is the new stepping stone to Antarctica.
Yeah.
Well,
we've
always been the stepping stone to Antarctica, haven't we?
Well, Christchurch and Hobart are the two main access points on via land.
What's in Antarctica that's so important?
More minerals than anywhere else in the earth.
Oh, really?
Yes, but it's under ice.
Mm.
But people think...
Well, at least melt it.
Well, but they are. That's part of the agenda.
Right.
I'm not an expert on all this.
As we speak, there is the largest seismic tester on this planet heading to New Zealand to do more seismic testing. But don't you worry about that. Just because it was off the coast of Kaikoura when the Kaikoura earthquake happened, don't you conspiracy theorists go drawing any conclusions now.
Absolutely. And just because thousands of whales wash up on the shore, it's a mystery illness.
It said they only use bubbles. That was the official word. Yeah, no, somebody did question it after the Kaikoura earthquake. And said, hang on, what about all these blasts going on? And the official, there was two sentences. And they said, they use a series of bubbles, much like the fishermen use sonar to find their fish. Nothing to look at here. Go back to sleep.
Well, Victoria, have you seen this? Have you seen this yet? Where earthquakes are attributed to climate change?
Look, this whole thing about carbon and climate change—it's just something to talk about that people can argue about, and we carry on polluting and warmongering like there's no tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Hey, nice one, Victoria.
Yeah, so anyway, peace and love.
Yeah.
And again, buy local from people you can trust who grow veggies down the road and pay for their own friggin' water systems.
Yeah.
Unlike the Lee Valley Dam proposal, who wants all of us to pay for one big stupid dam on a fault line. But don't you worry, because look here, I read in the paper, I even saved it, darling, to share it with you. Where is it? headline. Dam collapse. Quote. Very unlikely in quake. So don't worry.
Oh, good. Oh, I feel safe now.
It's very unlikely.
An expert said that, darling.
But it's okay. I feel really safe over here. We're not going to get affected by the dam collapse, are we?
So we just pay for it.
Oh, yeah.
You got to do your bit.
Can I share something really important that relates?
Everything's important, Jeff. Everything.
Absolutely. There's this guy named Elon Musk.
Yeah.
And he's a Canadian and South African guy, and he's one of the billionaires up there with Richard Branson, people like that, kind of an entrepreneur, but pretty much of a scientific mad scientist kind of guy. And he's founded the Tesla electric car company and this company called SpaceX that's determined to go and live on Mars. Well, did you know, this is fully documented, that he recently broke into his piggy bank and spent $700 trillion to purchase the entire U.S. military apparatus.
Oh, really?
So that he can use it to wage war on climate change.
Brilliant.
And his reasoning...
He's saved.
Well, exactly.
But, he's a hero.
But listen to this. His reasoning is flawless. He reckons that if you don't have a climate... you can't have climate change. So what they're going to do is use the U.S. military to rid the Earth of its atmosphere.
What a good idea.
So then we won't have any climate, and therefore we'll be done with climate change.
Brilliant. I love it.
But I wrote a very in-depth article about this.
Okay.
And I think that it got banned on Facebook because the computer recognition things thought that I was revealing all these secrets of the U.S. military stockpile, because I listed all the stuff that he got with the deal, like 10,842 nuclear missiles, 243 there's a list of 30 different things that he got with this deal, including like 18 octillion barrels of oil that go to run all this stuff for hundreds of years, you know, and like...
So,
but some people actually believe this.
Oh, I do. Is it not true, really?
Of course it's true.
Oh, well.
We're saved.
I was a bit worried. I thought we weren't saved, but we are saved. Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, they even have a battle anthem. They've got a battle anthem. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Climate change, we're gonna do ya. We'll kick you in your teeth and knock you on your sorry ass, cause you love carbon dioxide gas.
Oh, you heard it first, live here on Fresh FM, Fresh Start Friday. This is the thing I wanted to touch on with you, Sammy, is the radio stuff that you do back in Australia. Now, you were also involved in this. How long have you been involved on the radio station?
So it's been about 6 months since I started a show with a friend over on the digital side of that station.
Yep.
Over in Brisbane, and I think another maybe 5 or 6 months on top of that since I started working, volunteering in the news department over there, putting together local news packages, local stories and stuff that matters to communities around town.
And it's something triple Z?
4ZZZ.
4ZZZ.
It started out in the University of Queensland, pretty underground, underneath the big performing arts theatre.
Okay.
In the basement there, and it's over, I think, since early 70s, maybe late 60s, I think. And it's now in its own building that's been there for 25 years, up in the valley, and it's... Yeah.
So how many studios? Have you got just one little studio like this, or three, or how?
Two studios.
Yeah.
It's not dissimilar to this. I mean, same board.
Yeah.
Same, you know, same contraptions. It's, you know, community radio is as it is.
Mm.
So... There's, you know, not too many insane bells and whistles. It does the job, but it's very, it does get the job done. It's a very nice studio, I will say.
And the shows, similar sort of thing, you know, teenage shows, ethnic music shows,
all sorts. I think it tries to, cover as wide of an array of groups as it can and cater to as many.
So you can look up. So if you type in 4ZZZ on Google, you'd probably come up with it somewhere along the line.
Yeah, and all those shows are available online to stream on demand, and some of them are available as podcasts as well. I know our show gets put out as a podcast every Monday.
Yep. What's the name of your show?
It's called In Bloom. It's a bit of a riff on that Nirvana track, and about youth. So we run a weekly hour show about high school music. So we interview high school musicians and kids around town starting bands, and talking about what matters to them.
May I ask you a question? Do you have a show or shows on the station that deals with Australian environmental issues?
We do, actually. There's a couple. There is a paradigm shift show. It goes out as a couple times a week, I believe, or once a week, and then Brisbane Line is the tri-weekly news program, and they cover a lot about that. But yeah, definitely environmental.
Do you listen to those?
Oh, I'm usually at school.
Okay.
when those go out, but they're all available online too. A lot of really well-informed people talking every week and bringing, you know, especially a lot of local, and especially because there's been a big election, all that happening up in Queensland at the moment, the state election, and talk about the Adani coal mine.
I was just going to ask.
It's been a big topic of contention. And
how do you pronounce the name of the Premier of Queensland?
Anastasia Palaszczuk.
Say it again.
Anastasia Palaszczuk.
Palaszczuk.
And you wouldn't perhaps read that as Palaszczuk.
Well, yes, I've never heard it pronounced, but yes, yeah. The Adani coal mine is like a very dangerous thing that, as far as I know, it's still proceeding full steam ahead.
Well, Labor's done a backflip on it, and has decided not to back it.
Really?
I do believe. Yeah.
What was controversial about it?
Well, it's going to be. It would be if they proceed as planned. It would be one of, if not the largest, ore loading facilities on the planet, of which Australia already has a lot. It would be an expansion of this place called Abbott Point, with and also basically strip mining vast areas of the Carmichael Basin for coal. This is coal. This shows you the backwardness of the whole Australian. I mean, Australia is my favorite country in the world. I love it, and that's why.
What about New Zealand?
Well,
how long are you going to stay here for?
New Zealand and Australia are really two parts of the same place.
No, we're not.
Australia is the West Island, and New Zealand's the easternmost state, and they're both basically states of the USA and colonies of England.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it's all immaterial. But I love Australia. But that's why I can say stuff like this, that it's like it's got some of the most backward social and environmental things happening on this planet. And it's the dark side of Australia, the fact that they're still mining massive amounts of coal, still mining and exporting massive amounts of uranium, second only to Canada. The treatment of the indigenous people, some of the most horrific policies that have ever existed, of literally institutionalized genocide disguised as, you know, social benefits and stuff like that. But, you know, I think that Australia, the land of Australia, is some of the most ancient crust, some of the most ancient surface area of land on Mother Earth that you can access. Only Greenland is older, but you can't just go to Greenland and contact the Earth because it's under an ice sheet. But in Australia, you can just go out and drive not that far and be with Earth that's like literally that hasn't changed all that much in billions of years. Mm. And it's such a very powerful, special place. And to protect what's left of the Earth of Australia and New Zealand too, everywhere is sacred, but These places are just so near and dear to my heart.
Well, I'm told the natives there wouldn't go near certain areas, and it turns out they turn them into uranium mines, right? That stuff, right?
The Adamanta indigenous people of the Flinders Ranges, they call it sickness country.
Right.
There's like pools of hot springs that it's highly radioactive water. They didn't know about radiation, but they knew you don't go there because you'd get really, really sick. And it is, it's radioactive. So the indigenous people have known all kinds of stuff like this. But it's back to like the Hopis.
Yeah. They're living on the earth with the earth. They're actually one with the earth, unlike us who try and separate nature from ourselves. You know, they are nature.
Yes.
We are nature, but we tend not to do that, do we?
Try and disassociate ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
But thanks for telling us about your radio station. That I'm glad that exists.
Yeah. So... And speaking of movements, look, you were talking about, Sammy, you were talking about the politics of Australia. You touched on the Pauline Hanson kind of regime.
Just how politicized.
Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, well, this recent election, I believe it's still too close to call. Well, last time I checked, they hadn't reached a consensus on the votes yet. But it was a very difficult situation for a lot of voters, I think, because of the Adani coal mine.
Yep.
And because of just how against the war a lot of voters seem to be there, because for a while vote Labour and that might carry on. They seem to be backing it for a long time. And then on the other side you have the LNP and...
What's that stand for, LNP?
Liberal National Party.
Okay, it just sounds like a drink over here. LNP.
Or it's something you burn in your stove.
Yeah.
So that's the coalition government at the moment,
right,
in power. And a lot of contention there about whether they are in cahoots or ready to join with One Nation, and obviously led by Pauline Hanson.
Yeah, she's a bit racist, right?
Well, may I bring in a comparison that relates with New Zealand? I'm originally from North Carolina.
Because we don't really have a racist... No racism here in that respect, I don't think.
Well, but there was this a legendary senator from North Carolina named Jesse Helms, and he was one of the most bigoted racist people. I mean, I sort of learned all this in hindsight because I always knew he was this dominant character, but I never really followed politics till much later. But in 1990, before I came down under, I was reading about New Zealand, and it was talking about how David Lange, who was the Prime Minister of New Zealand in 1985, he's who declared the anti-nuclear status here. And Senator Helms was head of the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Senate Agricultural Committee, and he was so angry at David Lange in New Zealand for not letting our nuclear-powered ships come here that he goes like,
I'm going to rip that turkey's face off. I'm going to destroy New Zealand's economy.
And he tried to,
as you do, right?
He tried to get a bunch of surplus American dairy products dumped on the world market to try to destroy New Zealand's economy.
And interestingly enough, I remember all that butter coming in here, this cheap American butter.
Really?
It wasn't even yellow, it was white. And it was not, you know, and everyone was like, where's this American butter coming from? Why are we importing American butter for?
It was actually Velveeta.
Ah.
But anyway, a full cycle has come because only last year, in November of last year, when the USS Sampson came, the first U.S. military warship allowed to be in New Zealand water since 1985.
And it was neither confirm nor deny of nuclear power?
Well, it was diesel powered, but that's just its propulsion. Any American boat is armed to the teeth. It's going to have micro-nuke missiles. It's going to have depleted uranium artillery. But even worse is all the microwave stuff. So I was talking about the dangers of having all these 30 different warships all armed with Raytheon microwave technologies and stuff, all converging on Auckland. And on the very morning that Operation Mahi Tangaroa commenced is when that giant 7.8 earthquake destroyed Kaikoura.
No coincidence, maybe. But, you know, that's an interesting bit of history. Thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate hearing that. You know, you've travelled the world, and this is probably the last opportunity we're going to have of having you on here, because obviously you're going to keep moving on next week, maybe. And it just seems like, you know, you continually travel. Where are the plans from here?
Well, supposed to be going back to Australia next week, mm-hmm. probably to Melbourne, and then down to Tasmania. And then I'm going to try to go. I want to go back to the Big Island of Hawaii sometime in the not-too-distant future in order to photograph the lava flowing into the ocean.
Oh, yeah. And you're going to get a new camera to do that with.
Yes, that'll
don't
be
happening. Don't burn it. It'll melt it with lava.
No, but you know, interestingly, I know a guy on Great Barrier Island. He's an American who used to be a video photographer for the Volcanoes National Park. And he actually has burn scars all over his legs from getting burned by lava. And he said he would stand and film and the soles of his boots would melt. And he's got video footage of literally a fountain of lava going a couple hundred feet in the air, and it's actually coming down around him. I've seen that, and all the other people he worked with
ran away quickly.
No, they did. They didn't live. He's the only one that survived, and so he quit while he was still ahead. But that was, I mean, imagining photographing erupting lava that's exploding a fountain 100 feet in the air, and it's coming down around you. He pushed the limit that far. I can't remember this guy's name, but it was a pretty legendary job to have.
Yeah, I reckon.
You hope his work gets appreciated after that.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't have any work after that, would you? You just run, yeah, right. You run away and become a ice scientist.
Yes. Grant, thank you so much for having us on. It's been a very, very wonderful pleasure to be here and talk with you. And
yeah, well, it's always good. You know, I mean, our listeners are always, I think, interested in hearing things different. That's what community radio is about, and sharing knowledge and sharing stories and bits and pieces from around the world. And you know, I'm impressed, Jeff, at the way you can remember names and
acronyms.
That's really you've got a real gift for that.
Well, part of it is the taking care of your brain, because it's either use it or lose it. And so I not only do I try to use my brain and in as many ways as possible, but my brain has a mind of its own. My brain is actually doing all this stuff below my level of awareness, and then when something cool comes up, it'll go, hey, write this down. You know, that's how my Elon Musk story came up, or that's how a lot of different things pop into your mind. So you can train your brain to do a lot of really cool stuff. And I'd also like to just add that I do hope to return to the Andromeda Galaxy one of these light years, and you're welcome anywhere there.
Oh, okay, good. Good. Where's the Andromeda Galaxy? You're a bit of an astronomer, aren't you?
It's only 1.2 million light years away. It's the closest galaxy that's similar in structure to ours. It's a spiral galaxy in the constellation Andromeda, which you can see it down here.
There was a band from Sweden called the Andromeda All-Stars.
Andromeda was a Greek goddess of something.
Yeah.
They were the house band.
But yes, we live in the universe, but we're all traveling in space and time, even as we're sitting here now.
Yeah, exactly. So, hey, look, thanks for sharing all that stuff. It's been fascinating, and, you know, thanks.
And I have one really important piece of information.
Only one?
Yes, and I actually won because I knew this. I was able to get a whole bunch of punches on my ice cream card, and because I knew this, I got a free ice cream. In Boulder, Colorado, I went in an ice cream shop, and they had a question. If you knew the answer, you got all these punches. And it was, what was the value of pi to 8 decimal places?
Oh, do you? Well,
and I knew it. 3.14159265.
Keep going.
I don't know. It doesn't repeat till you get to a million.
Yeah.
But that's need-to-know information.
Absolutely.
You got to Boulder, Colorado.
Right. Thank you.